Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Thank you all for joining us for the third installment of my musical journey with David Crosby, whose innovative songwriting and heavenly harmony vocals helped elevate groups like The Byrds and CSNY to superstardom and change the face of much of the popular music that followed, creating a distinctively haunting sound that dozens of pop acts have emulated since, but rarely to such exquisite effect. We also talk about one of the most painful experiences of David's life, the death in a car accident of the love of his life at the time, a lovely spunky woman named Christine Gale Hinton, who was tragically killed taking her cat to the vet. David explains how his creative collaborations with musicians like Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead and Paul Kantner and Grace Slick of the Jefferson Airplane, who helped him craft his solo album If I Could Only Remember My Name, helped him get through this difficult time. The resulting album was a masterpiece that stands today as one of the pinnacles of folk-influenced rock music that transcends all categories.
Why I was crying.
David, we have some really exciting news for our listeners. You are going to undertake a tour next year with two of your favorite singer-songwriters. Nobody knows about this. Can you tell us what's going to happen?
It's really fun. Mark Cohen and Sean Colvin, who are two of the people I admire most. I mean, you know that, right? When people ask me, who do you listen to? That's very often the first two names that pop up. You know, those two, Steely Dan, the Beatles, you know, they're right up there. So Mark called me up and said, hey, listen, I've got an idea I'd like to do a tour with you and Sean and do it Songwriter Circle, Nashville Songwriter Circle, which means the three of us go on stage, we sit down together in a circle, just us, and we trade songs, which is big fun. It sounds like a competition, but I don't think it's going to be. I think what'll happen is we'll wind up adding into each other's song, which could be stunning because the two of them are two of the most talented musicians I have ever run into.
And they're both not only great singers, they're great players.
They're great players and they're really good people.
Yeah.
You know, I've spent a lot of time with both of them and I love them both.
Yeah.
You kind of have to be selective about who you're going to be in a bus with.
Right. So that's how you're going to do it? All on
a
bus?
Well, you don't have any choice, man. That's the only way we can do tours. And until you get up to the, like the Rolling Stones level, then you can have a plane.
Right, right.
You know, when we were CSNY touring baseball stadiums, right. We had a plane, you know.
Right.
But it's the only way musicians can do it now. Mm-hmm. Until you get down below our level, and then they do it in a van.
Right.
And that's really grim because there's no place to sleep. You're doing it sitting up.
And in fact, what's funny about both Sean and Mark is that I've had them both in my life for quite a while. You turned me on to Sean's first album, Steady On. I remember a long time ago, we were in the car and you said, this is the best new album I've heard in years.
Yeah.
And I thought, is this more Crosbosity hyperbole here? And you popped it in. My mind was completely blown.
Yeah.
I listened to like nothing else for a month.
Well, that's like that. You know, Down the Avalanche, you know. Yep. I mean, it's like, it's over and over again, song after song.
Yep.
She just blows your mind. You know, she and Ann Leventhal, who co-wrote that shit.
The backwards guitars on Steady On and stuff.
Leventhal's really, really good. Leventhal overdoes producing, but what he does is excellent.
Yeah.
He overdoes it. He does too much, a little too much percussion, a little too much. Oh, maybe some tambourine in the fast part. Mm-hmm. He could do it a little more sparsely, and I would like it. Personally, I would like it better. But the stuff that he did on her records is masterful.
Yep.
He produced the spots out of them, really did a great job.
Yep. And the thing about Mark Cohen, which even he doesn't know, is that when I was a student at Oberlin, way back in the 1970s, children, I used to go see Mark play at a coffee house called The Cat and the Cream. And Mark was excellent then.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, went on to have a huge hit with Walking in Memphis. And
you know, the hit was almost a distraction from his real career.
Yeah.
And he could have had a hit career if one person at Atlantic had been smarter. He had a hit on the second record. It was called Paper Walls.
Yeah.
They didn't realize it was a hit because they didn't know squat. The people who ran record companies are failed shoe salesmen. They had absolutely no idea. You know, so they picked the one that sounded most like Walking in Memphis.
Right.
That's the closest they could come to figuring it out.
Right.
But there was a song on there, Paper Walls, guaranteed hit. He would have had his second hit, and then he would have been a huge pop star. But it's kind of good that he didn't.
Yeah.
Because really the quality in Mark is in the depth of the writing.
Yeah.
It's in the listening to Leave On.
Yeah.
I Might Have Lied About the Car.
Yeah.
It's in Can I Be Your Witness.
Yeah.
It's in the quality of the songs that he's written. That's where the real value in the guy is, man.
Yeah.
He's written songs that make me cry.
Yeah.
That rock me back on my heels.
Yeah.
That's the name of the game.
Well, one of the songs of his that rocks me back on my heels, makes me cry, and gives me those good kind of shivers down my back is She's Becoming Gold, which you and Nash did the background vocals.
Wasn't that fun for? That was really fun.
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable.
Nash and I did a lot of great background vocals for people, and Nash had an idea that I wished he had carried out, which he never did, which was to take all of those, get permission from each of those people, which I'm sure we could do, and do a benefit record of just those songs.
Oh, yeah.
Us singing with Gilmore, us singing with Joni, us singing with
James Taylor.
With James, you know, Mexico.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Lighthouse.
Yeah, because those are really good songs. Yeah. And we did it over and over again. We did it with John.
Yeah.
You know, done it with lots of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, he had an idea about who he wanted to have be the beneficiary too.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just never did it. Yeah. I don't know why. But
did you guys feel like the baddest ass harmony singers basically around?
We are
like
both very
the
good
hired guns kind of thing.
Yeah, no, we are both very good harmony singers. I'm better than he is, but we're both good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's great.
He said modestly.
Vendôme.
So speaking of your harmonies, I know that one of the first harmonies that impressed you was the Everly Brothers.
Hard not to. It was such a natural thing.
So you were what, like 10 or something when you were hearing them? Or
a little older than that. I was a freshman at Kate, you know, a freshman in high school, whatever that is.
This is a really deep question, but what is it about singing harmony that appeals to you?
God, I wish I could put salt on its tail for you. I wish I could tell you. I don't exactly know. There's some part of me that wants to be in a relationship with other human beings, that wants to fly wing and wing.
Yeah.
You know, that thing that fighter pilots do?
Yeah.
I like that. I don't know what it is. So there's some part of me that wants that.
Yeah.
In a very deep level. Yeah. The minute I did it, I liked it.
Yeah.
It was on a song called The Erie Canal.
Huh.
Something about it rang my bell. The deeper it goes, the more it rings my bell. The Everlys rang my bell because it was so naturally correct.
Yeah.
It was so on it. They were so tight with each other.
Yeah.
Expression, attack, decay, tone, everything, really. Then I heard a great record, one of the most influential records of my life. It's called The Music of Bulgaria by Philip Kutchev and the Bulgarian National Folk Choir and Orchestra. And it's on Nonesuch, a label that used to be part of Elektra. And it was in the 60s. And it was the first time that anybody recorded the Bulgarian folk choir. And that record changed my life about harmonies. Because they sang stuff that I had never even heard anybody try, let alone pull off. There's a song on there, man, where they rotate three voices around each other in half steps and pull it off. No accompaniment. Perfectly. In pitch. Half steps. It's so brilliant. It would have stumped the Beach Boys. It would have stumped anybody, any of us. None of us could do that. And none of us could do any of the things they were doing. And it changed me. It opened up so much possibility to me. You know, I mean, Brian Wilson's the kind of that experience, you know, when you hear him do that, you didn't expect that. When you first encountered it, it thrilled you, right? It's an odd vanilla kind of strain, but it's really good. Well, these people were that, but with hot sauce. They were beyond good. They were revelatory. They were mind expanding. Bob Dylan influenced me strongly. Ask me how.
Well, how? And
because I didn't want to sound like that.
right. Now, is it true that the Byrds got early access to an acetate demo of Mr. Tambourine Man?
Yes,
how did that happen?
Our manager knew the guy that was managing Bob. And it was a terrible demo. It was him and Ramblin' Jack Elliott, who couldn't sing his way out of a paper bag.
Yeah.
And it was awful.
Yeah.
But you could hear the words.
Yeah.
And you could hear the song. And McGuinn, God bless him, man. McGuinn is a strange piece of fruit. But boy, he knows how to take Bob Dylan songs and make a record out of them.
Yeah.
He's a freaking genius at it.
Yeah.
He's got some kind of absolute window there.
Yeah.
The funny part was watching Bob.
So did he come down to the studio?
He came to the studio on 3rd Street down there. And he we played it, and it was you could hear the gears grinding all the way from the next room.
Yeah.
He was stunned and happy and stoked and excited, and he knew exactly what he was going to do next. And he went straight out of that room and got himself an electric band right away, immediately.
So you think hearing the birds do Mr. Tambourine Man based on the acetate demo influenced Bob to hire the Hawks, basically?
I don't have any question in my mind at all.
Wow.
That's when he went out and got the first band that he got was Cooper and
Bloomfield.
And Bloomfield.
Yeah.
And those guys. And it wasn't very good.
Yeah.
Bloomfield was real scratchy and crazy at that point.
Although it worked on the records, I'll tell you.
It worked okay, yeah. but it got a lot better when he got the band.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they were freaking awesome.
For sure.
Different level of ability.
Yeah.
You know, they could write.
Yeah. Do you remember hearing the band's music early on?
Oh, yeah, I remember exactly how it happened.
Because, yeah, tell me, actually.
Well, the guy who managed them, the guy who we knew, he was a mover and shaker in the business, and he walked into my dealer's house, where I was at the time purchasing chemicals, and said, "Oh, you birds are through." And I said, "We are." And he said, "Yeah, you're over with. It's done. This record," and he held up Big Pink.
Oh, wow.
"Is going to knock you out of the box.
Wow.
You're going to have trouble even getting a job."
Wow.
And I said, "Bullshit. Put it on."
Yeah.
Listen to it. I said, "Oh, fuck."
Yeah.
It was so good, man.
Yeah.
The songs were so good.
Yeah.
Richard Emmanuel was so good.
Yeah.
Levon was so good.
Yeah.
Listening to Levon, bring us back to Mark Cohen.
Right.
His song about Levon is a perfect example of why I respect Mark as much as I do.
Yeah, yeah.
It's listening to Levon is one of the best songs of anybody's that I ever heard.
Oh, that's great. Those early band albums also very much influenced the Grateful Dead in terms of going in the direction of American Beauty and Working Man's Dead instead of psychedelic.
Well, you couldn't not be influenced by that. It's like not being influenced by Bob.
Right.
It's like not being influenced by Joni.
Right.
People do work at a level sometimes that is, you can't deny it. It's undeniable. Right. It's there. It's gigantic in your presence, and you can't not be influenced by it.
Right.
Beatles.
Right.
What happened to you the first time you heard the Beatles? You went, oh, give me some of that. Let me rub that in my hair. I want to take a shower in that.
Yeah. Do you actually remember the first few times you heard the Beatles?
Absolutely.
Where were you?
I was in Chicago. I was on Well Street in the apartment that Clem Floyd and I shared.
And who
he brought home Meet the Beatles.
Uh-huh.
And we put it on.
Yeah.
And it was heaven.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was heaven. It was folk music meets the backbeat.
Right.
That's what happens with synthesis, man. When you take disparate streams and mix them, and they create new stuff.
Yep.
And that's what the Beatles did.
Yeah, yeah,
They took folk music changes and applied them to rock and roll backbeat and rock and roll singing.
Yep.
And they created a whole new art form.
It probably didn't hurt your image of them that they were followed by crowds of screaming teenage girls.
I totally didn't. I ignored that. Who cares about crowds of screaming girls? Right. Oh, no. We're not interested in girls.
Did you see Help back then?
Sure, of course.
Was it like, oh, yeah, I want to do that?
By that time, I was a deep fan. No, Hard Day's Night was what got
us. Hard Day's Night, right.
Hard Day's Night freaked us the fuck out.
Yeah.
We saw it. Roger and I went to see it together.
Oh, wow.
I think Gene was with us too.
Wow.
And might have been Michael and might have been all of us. But I think Roger and I saw it together. All right. Now I know what I'm here for.
Right.
That's it. That's who I want to be right there.
Right. What are your best memories of being in the Byrds?
Driving down Sunset Boulevard in Odetta's old 1956 Ford station wagon, all five of us with our gear in the back and on KRLA, which was the radio station in Los Angeles at the time. And we're thrilled. We're freaking out. It was the first time we heard anything of ours on the radio. And it was just unbelievably great. And they finished it, and they were raving over it, and they played it again.
Oh, my God.
I'd never heard them ever play a song twice in a row.
Wow.
And we had to pull over.
Wow.
We were like dancing around the car.
Wow.
We could not believe. We were so freaking happy. It was a joy. But there were many times for the birds, man, many times when, you know, 8 miles high was a really satisfying piece of work.
Yeah.
But there were many. I remember the night that we worked out Chimes of Freedom.
Mm.
Boy, was I happy. Mm. You know, it's the first time that I actually been able to contribute on the guitar.
Oh, wow.
That's looping kind of lines, you know, mm-hmm. that are on there. And there were many. Many, there was a good chemistry
yeah.
in the early days. And we hadn't irritated each other mm-hmm. yet. We still believed mm-hmm. in each other. And mm-hmm. it was pretty great.
Mm-hmm. Could you go back through a couple of Birds tracks and point, like, there's, you know, obviously a ton of has been written about the Birds. But your specific contribution has been left somewhat vague and abstract.
Well, it's like, odd.
Right. So what was your contribution to the Birds, really?
I wrote the weird shit. Mm-hmm. Same as usual.
You did, but the stuff that wasn't written, that wasn't original material, like Bells of Rimney or whatever, did you have anything to do, like, did you architect the harmonies or anything like that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it wasn't, you know, people always say, how did you structure that? As if I had right. written them out, you know.
Right,
like,
right.
And then the fifth has to be here. And then, right. It's not like that at all. I just sang it.
Right.
I sang what came to me to sing. I didn't plan any of that shit. That was Bells of Rimney was Roger again.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
he was a folk musician. He knew all those songs, and he knew some that were naturally freaking wonderful. Turn, turn, turn.
Right.
Roger.
Right.
Bells of Rimney. Roger.
Right.
Tambourine Man. Roger.
Right.
The guy absolutely did know what he was doing.
Right.
And I don't know if I gave him credit for that. I certainly followed him. I yeah. certainly believed in him.
Mm-hmm.
But in hindsight, he was, you know, half the Birds.
Right, right, right.
That's why I don't want to do it without him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I could. I own the name.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, yeah. Now, what would you say your best compositions that were recorded by the Birds were? Because some of your stuff was, like, left off of albums. Like, some of the stuff that I like that you probably don't even like It Happens Each Day. I think that's a brilliant track, actually.
Like a silent ray of sunlight.
You don't like it.
Yeah, it's beginning stuff. Right. You know, I mean, it's okay, but it's early, you know, early stuff. I don't really give myself points on anything until
Everybody's Been Burned.
Everybody's Been Burned probably is the first one that I can stand to listen to.
Yeah, yeah. And you had written that actually before the Birds, apparently.
No.
It says in your book, actually, that it was earlier.
That I started it earlier?
Yeah, that you started it earlier.
I've probably lied.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Nah.
Yeah, it's an excellent song.
I don't know. I think that's the first one where I'd look back and I'd say that, you know, I was starting to be able to write a song.
Yeah. Yeah. It has that distinctive sort of floating feeling that you turned into a career, really. You know, it's like it has that it has the Crosby vibe.
Crosby vibe is just I was stoned when I did it. I mean, you guys.
But when you get stoned, something special happens, apparently.
Everybody has been burned before. Everybody knows the pain. Anyone in this place can tell you to your face why you shouldn't try to let someone.
So tell us about like playing at Ciro's and suddenly being the thing with the Birds, with Peter Orlovsky and Allen Ginsberg, as we spoke of earlier. What was it like to be the thing suddenly in this center of this entertainment industry that you had grown up around?
Well, it was great. Mm-hmm. I got laid.
Right. A lot.
A lot. And that was really sort of when that started. And it was really good. And I approve of all of that. Totally.
Yes, yes.
The young guy trying to rub the velvet off his antlers. And
right, right.
That's how you do it. And so musically, it was a thrill. Because people loved us. Mm-hmm. And we were pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a shame. I'm not sure that I could. Matter of fact, I won't tell you why I think they don't want to do it with me.
Mm-hmm.
But there are reasons and they're not good ones.
That's okay. One thing I would like to get straight, finally, if that's the word, is what happened? Did you leave on your own steam or did they kick you out or what was
No, they absolutely kicked me out.
And one hears, you know, it's because you were an asshole or whatever. What was really going on? Because you were actually
normal stuff that happens in groups always. Ego conflict between people who are competing with each other and being kids. We were young guys who had, you know, balls the size of oranges and brains the size of a pea.
Right.
And we had no experience. So we did not know how valuable what we were doing was.
Yeah.
We did not know how valuable the friendship was or the comradeship was.
Right.
And we didn't, you know, give each other the room or the respect. The one I regret the most is Gene.
Yeah.
Gene was a talented guy.
Yeah.
And we all but forced him out of the Birds.
Yeah. Yeah, I just heard for the first time in my life his solo album, which I believe is called No Other, or one of his solo albums.
It's pretty good.
It's awesome. Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah, amazing arrangement.
He's a talented guy.
Yeah.
And we should have managed to keep him where he was, being the lead singer front for the band.
Right.
But Roger was a better singer.
Yeah.
And a much better storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, and I was a much better guitar player. He was a very awkward guitar player. So that's why he wound up with the tambourine.
Mm.
We didn't value him enough.
Mm-hmm.
Or we would have spotted that he was getting unhappy and we would have kept him happy.
Right.
We would have found a way to keep him at the center of things.
Right.
You know, he's a good guy.
This is Tom Marshall with Osiris, here to tell you that Freak Flag Flying is brought to you by Pilsner Urquell Beer. In 1842, Pilsner Urquell brewed the world's first golden Pilsner in the city of Pilsen, in the Czech Republic. It is still brewed in the same brewery today, using the same Czech ingredients. There are a lot of crazy beers out there these days, and sometimes I just need a lager, specifically a Pilsner. Pilsners I find to be crisper and cleaner tasting than other beer types, and Pilsner Urquell, I feel, has the formula just right. It's not fruity or bitter or overhopped. The malt and hop flavors are just balanced perfectly. They've had 178 years to perfect it. You should give it a try. Pilsner Urquell makes sure that all their beer arrives in the U.S. in less than 31 days. The product is refrigerated the entire time from the brewery in Pilsen to the distributor warehouse in the U.S. to ensure the beer tastes the same here as it does in the brewery in Pilsen. You can find Pilsner Urquell in your local grocery store, available in cans and brown bottles for freshness. To enjoy Pilsner Urquell at its best, consider pouring it into a Pilsner mug. Thank you, Pilsner Urquell.
Now, so far you've asked, we've been in here for an hour and 10 minutes, and you have asked me nothing but softball. I'd like to point that out.
Okay.
Because that's because you're a wuss.
Okay.
And you're kind of chicken.
Okay.
To deal any real serious cards off the top of the deck. I'm just pointing it out.
Okay.
No pressure, though.
All right. Let me ask you a question.
Watch out.
Here
it comes.
Here it comes. Your father was not the most expressive man.
Oh, boy, is that an understatement.
He did not overwhelm you as Jan, your wife, does, with advocating his love for you.
No, Jandy's very good at loving. She's the one who taught me how.
Right. So here's the question. It is no secret to anyone that you have a great need for acclaim.
Approval.
Approval.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely. You call it scratching behind your ears.
I'm always looking for approval from everybody I talk to. It's kind of a genetic thing with me. I can't help it.
Right.
It's just how I am. And I've learned to deal with it, you know.
Do you think that's in part because you did not hear it much from your dad?
I don't know. That's psychology, and maybe yes.
Uh-huh.
It makes sense on the face of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all so deep, and there's always so many variables involved in a person's mm-hmm. life that it's really hard to isolate a single cause for a single
mm-hmm.
effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually a multiplicity of stuff affecting a multiplicity of outcomes, right?
That's true.
So it's very tangled web.
Yeah.
My dad didn't know how to love anybody because he'd never been shown. His mother never loved anything.
Right.
She didn't like a fork and spoon.
Right.
Let alone her kid.
Right.
And so he was never shown any love. At all.
Right.
None. Zero. Period. I met the woman. I know he didn't.
Yeah.
So he was lousy at it.
Yeah.
He was very good at managing a Mitchell, you know, camera.
Yeah.
Knew exactly about light and focal planes and distances and knew that shit.
Yeah.
Down. He was technically a very, very good cinematographer.
Right.
But he was a dick. He had no idea how to be a decent human being at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He screwed both his kids over and his wife.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, the way that he made his career was doing high. He was a cinematographer, correct? Mm, yeah. Very well known. Nanook of the North, High Noon, etc. Did that introduce you to, you know, the entertainment industry and those people?
Yeah, that's what I thought I wanted to do. I wanted to be an actor.
Oh, wow. And what put you off that?
The time frame.
Yeah.
If you want to be a success as an actor, you have to have actually made a movie that somebody saw.
Right.
That could take a year or two.
Right.
Just to get in a movie.
Right.
It could take 10 years.
Right.
When you do that, then finally a year later, the movie might come out.
Right.
I could go down to the coffee house, and if I look properly mournful, I could get laid that night.
Right. Right, right, right. For sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you ever make peace with your father?
No.
No.
He died before I got sober.
Oh, he died right when you were actually about to go to jail.
83. Right?
Did he know how messed up you were?
Yes.
He did. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was very disturbed by it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You did, however, even though your parents divorced before you got there, or before you got to this point, you were on good terms with your mom when she was dying, which you write about in Carry Me, correct?
Yes.
So that really happened. Carry Me really happened. Can you tell that story?
She was dying. And as they still do, the hospitals put you on painkillers and keep you there. And most people just go along with it. It's a shitty way to die. Alone, a bunch of strangers, cold place. Painkillers, tubes stuck in you everywhere, scared to death. I would be. I went to see her, and we knew she was dying. She had cancer. And she had told him not to give her the painkillers so she could be able to talk to me. I guess she was on a lot of them. And she said, I feel like a bird with weights tied to its feet wanting to fly. She said, it's time for me to go. Those exact words. And I said, God, I what can I do? She said, well, you could do it. Would you? And I said, absolutely. I mean, set a caged animal free. Of course I would. So I went to find out. I talked to a doctor friend of mine, and he said, well, you don't have access to any of the poisons that would do it, you know, things that would poison her or upset her system drastically enough to where she would go. And all of those leave traces and stuff, but you could maybe do it this way. And he told me a way that I could do it. And I went back and I said, okay, all right. And she said, we can't. I said, why not? It's because I talked to them here. And if I die ahead of schedule, those words.
Wow.
Ahead of schedule.
Mm.
They'll do an autopsy and they'll charge you with murder.
Mm.
She said, so I'm just going to let it happen on its own.
And then there was my mother. She was lying white sheets there and she was waiting to die. She said, if you just reach underneath this bed and untie these weights, I could surely fly. She's still smiling, but she's tired. She'd like to hear that last bell ring. You know, if she still could, she would stand up. She could sing, carry me, oh, carry me, ooh, carry me above the world. Ooh, carry me, ooh, carry me, yeah.
Ooh. That's intense. So many intense things happen to you around the early 70s, late 60s.
Yeah, you know, life is intense.
No, but it was especially intense. For instance, everybody, when I started really becoming obsessed with your music, really, if I could only remember my name, your first, you know, quote unquote solo album, which has everybody on it from Jerry Garcia to Joni Mitchell to Neil to Paul Kantner to everybody, Laura Allen. Everybody. That album was somewhat overlooked. It had been dismissed by the pundits at Rolling Stone as self-indulgent or whatever.
Mediocre was the word they used.
I thought it was a masterpiece, one of the highlights of, you know, all of music. You know, I put it up there in my mind. You know, this is me. I'm weird. But I put it up there in my mind with Miles Davis Kind of Blue, Miles Davis in a Silent Way, Bill Evans of the Village Vanguard. Like, that was the stature that I gave it in my mind. And it's everything about it. It's not just each individual track. It's not just who's on it. It's the sequence. It's a journey. It takes you somewhere. Yes, it's the vibe. It sucks you in. But what, for most people who listen to it, it's a very uplifting experience. But what they don't know, most of them, is that you were going through one of the most difficult times of your entire life.
Well, I was fighting darkness, so I was shedding a lot of light.
Right, exactly. Do you remember those sessions?
Very well.
Tell me what it was like to have, you know, Jerry walk in and say, oh, I could play this, or, you know, Paul walking in.
It was a number of things. A, there was a certain rush of somebody likes me because they knew that I was in trouble.
Yeah.
They were all very aware of Christine's death because it happened right there in Novato.
Right.
When I was living next, you know, pretty much next door to Mickey. And it was one of their guys that was that drove me to the hospital.
Right. And you had just moved there, correct?
Yeah. Well, a few months before.
Mm-hmm.
And we were pretty close at that point. And
mm-hmm.
him walking in the door was like a gesture of friendship.
Mm-hmm.
He was a guy that everybody was fascinated with and everybody wanted him to walk through the door.
We're talking about Garcia right now, right?
Yeah. When you show up, you know the guy, man. It'd be the grin.
Yeah.
And then look in the eyes.
Yeah.
And this fascination with the music.
Yeah.
Easy, not forced.
Yeah.
Graceful, fun, ever present. Play two notes, you had his attention. Talk to him for an hour, you might not get it. Play two notes, you get it.
Yeah.
He was a startlingly well-focused human being. It's the first time I ran into it was him. I've seen that quality in other human beings and liked it. I saw it in McGuinn. I saw it in Stills, you know, but...
Michael League, it sounds like.
Michael League is a prime, fantastic, shining, gigantic example of exactly that. You know? Jerry had it in spades. It was a kindness, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
He never said that.
Yeah.
Never even implied it.
Right.
Just, hey, I heard you were doing something. what are you doing?
Yeah, right.
Let's do something.
Right.
There was no implication that it was a mercy fuck.
Right.
But I think it was. Mm. I think Paul, too. I think Grace, too. Mm. I think they all knew.
Now, it was a pretty radical decision at the time for you to play songs like Tamil Pious High and Song With No Words and not write lyrics for them. Tam High, you'd written in this kind of amazing so-called sky drop period when you were had just left the Byrds, around the same time you wrote Wooden Ships, etc. Do you remember like thinking, okay, I'm going to put these songs on this record without lyrics?
Didn't think about it that way. I thought them up knowing what I was going to do.
Okay.
Which nobody else did. Everybody else thought they were unfinished songs because
right.
they did not hear the song until I put that Mormon Tabernacle Me
right.
stack on top of it.
Right.
That's when it made sense.
Right.
We played it. I said, these are the changes. Let's play them. We played them gloriously. And, you know, I mean, one of them is the only time anybody ever got Garcia and Yorma in the same fucking
yeah.
record.
Yeah,
totally. And they played great together.
Yeah.
But I knew that that's what I was going to do.
Yeah.
They weren't unfinished songs to me. They were something people that just didn't understand yet because they hadn't heard the horn stack.
Yeah.
And that's all I did was I made a horn record with voices.
Yeah.
That's all I did.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, those songs are, that's what they are.
Yeah.
And I'm now negotiating with a horn player to try and put together, translate them back into horn for a horn orchestra to do.
Yeah.
I think it'll sound fantastic.
Yeah.
Those same stacks. And then you take off into soloing, you know.
Yeah.
I think it'll be a good band record. I'm happy about that. I think I'm happiest about I'd Swear There Was Somebody Here.
And that was all you?
That's all me. They're all me.
Well, not really. I mean, there's a lot, you know, I mean, other people play amazing
yeah.
stuff on it. Yeah.
Yeah. But the vocal stacks.
Yes.
Those are me.
Yes, absolutely.
On I'd Swear There Was Somebody Here, that's six passes in an echo chamber. I was standing in an echo chamber. Or maybe I was just trying out an echo chamber at Wally Hivers. Live echo chamber, real chamber echo.
Yeah.
It was so good. And then something happened. I was very high. And something happened. And I thought she was there.
Yeah.
I could see her almost. Was spooky, and it might be my best piece of music.
Yeah.
I did an interesting thing recently. A friend of mine, Becca's husband, Nathan Schramm, he's a really good violist, and he's in a really good string quartet in New York called the Attic Quartet, really good. He did I'd Swear There Was Somebody Here. He actually figured out what I sang and did it with string.
Seriously?
Yeah, I played.
Is this available anywhere?
Yeah, no, it's not available, but I have
it. Wow. That's amazing.
I have it.
Yeah.
We're going to do something with it. We're not sure. Either we're going to expand on it. He and I need to get together and write some more for it because there's more that can happen. And it works really well with strings.
Oh, that's great.
It really works well. He made a demo of it just using his viola.
Wow.
And it was scary.
Wow.
Really good.
And that was a completely spontaneous improvisation on your part,
yeah.
correct? With like Stephen Barnhart running around trying to capture it all.
All he did was just keep pushing record.
Yeah.
I said, go to the top. Go again. Top. Go again. six times.
Did you listen to it right away and say, holy fuck?
No, I kept singing.
Yeah, that's amazing. If we could talk about one more track on that record, Laughing, which is, you know, many people's favorite track of yours, really. Fantastic crew on it, including Jerry Garcia playing the best pedal steel he ever played.
Early on. Yes. Very early pedal steel from Jerry.
Yep, yep, yep. Joni on harmonies. Do you remember putting that all together, or was it just like there were a bunch of people around Wally Hyder, so let's all sing on this?
It was such a good story, you know, and they knew. I told them why I had written it and who I'd written it to.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew the story.
Which was George Harrison, correct?
Yeah. George had, in his love of Indian music, gone to India.
Yep.
And he'd encountered a guru, a teacher.
Right.
It was
Maharaji, correct?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so he told me about it, and he said, you know, he thought that the guy had some value, and he was going back, and he applauded the guy pretty well. And I wanted to say, you know, because I'm very skeptical about that shit. I'm agnostic as hell, and I don't, like, anytime you start telling me you know what God wants, I start, you know, headed for the door, because it's bullshit, usually.
Mm-hmm. Particularly if God hates the same people you do.
Yeah.
Which is very popular these days.
Usually, almost always you're into trouble there.
Right.
So this guy, I wanted to say, listen, take it with a grain of salt.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that's all I wanted to say. And I was chicken to do it because it was George.
Mm-hmm.
I held him in very high esteem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the song instead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. It's me saying that I thought the laughter of a child was a better prayer than any of the things that teachers and gurus and priests, any of them, had to say. And I don't know if George ever heard it. But it made a good song.
Yeah, yeah.
Made a good song because it's very sincere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was a hell of a band. Phil Lesh from the Dead hardly ever sounded better on any other recording.
You know, Phil's playing and the fact that he loves to improvise, that he's not a normal bass player, affects the Grateful Dead style and is one of the reasons the Grateful Dead wound up playing the way they did.
Yeah.
Is Phil.
Yeah.
But on that particular song, at that particular moment, in that particular night, he almost played like a real bass player.
Mm.
He was very respectful of the tune.
Right.
Because he loved the tune.
Right.
And they all knew the story.
Right, right. Do you remember the final vocal crescendo with Joni skimming over the top? Like, do you remember putting that together?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I remember wishing she'd stick to the part. And then and listening to it afterwards and realizing how beautiful it was.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I think there are a couple of passes by her, actually,
yeah, sure.
In that crescendo. Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite moments in music. That's the moment that I think the whole, you know, counterculture thing won forever in immortality, that vocal crescendo.
Yeah, and there's Paul in there. There's David Freiberg's in there.
Yep.
Grace is in there real strong.
Yeah.
A lot of people in there. Nash is in there. A ton of my friends are in there. It's really good.
And it's very organic. It's like a beautiful out-breath in a way. Like, it's almost as if everyone's like sighing in some exquisite, peaceful way that leaves a silence inside of you afterwards.
I thought I met a man who said he knew a man who knew what endless darkness. I was mistaken. Only reflections of a shadow that I saw.
Freak Flag Flying is proud to be sponsored by Vermont Pure CBD. Vermont Pure CBD grows their own organic hemp, processes their own oil, and makes their own products, all in Shoreham, Vermont. They use sustainable and natural methods to grow and transform hemp into healthy products, including the highest quality full-spectrum CBD products. They have tinctures and topicals, skin creams and balms, and edibles like CBD dark chocolate and even CBD capsules. Vermont Pure CBD is committed to only using the most natural, unprocessed, sustainable, and local products. They happily choose to pay more for ingredients that meet these criteria to keep the overall quality high and to support responsible producers. Vermont Pure CBD treats every plant, every product, and every customer with the care and respect they deserve. Try it out today. Go to VermontPureCBD.com and enter the code OSIRIS on the shopping cart page to get 15% off your order. Vermont Pure CBD. Enjoy your wellness.
What are some of the musical opportunities that you would have liked to take up if you could relive your life again?
I wish I could have had some much deeper contact with Richard Emanuel and Levi Helm.
Mm-hmm.
And Rick.
Mm-hmm.
Not Robbie.
Mm-hmm.
But the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
I would have liked to have crossed paths with them much tighter.
Yeah.
They impress the shit.
Yeah.
They do to this day.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
I would very much like to have written with George.
Mm-hmm.
I was not confident enough to even think of it, let alone suggest it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have loved to have mixed music with George because he was a fine human.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a tough guy from a tough neighborhood who paid mm-hmm. tough dues,
mm-hmm.
worked in bars where they threw bottles at you, okay?
Yeah.
He's not a wussy little hippie kid. He's a tough kid.
Right.
And he was just naturally a decent guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have loved to have gotten way deeper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not John. Mm-hmm. Not Paul.
Mm-hmm.
I like Paul.
Mm-hmm.
I admire Paul tremendously as a writer, mm-hmm. particularly in being courageous enough to write Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah.
Because it's one that it's a place nobody else, you know.
Right.
All the other writers, my dick is big and you love me and I'm cool. And
right.
Isn't this just fantastic?
Right.
He's like looking at lonely, old, fragile people that nobody else even notices
mm-hmm.
and making you care about them.
Mm-hmm.
That's fucking good art, man.
It is good art. And actually, you've done it too. And I'll give you an example. Come through here quite often.
Isn't that
You're
good?
Writing about a waitress, you know.
Isn't that a good one, man?
Yeah, it's great. It's
yeah, I
beautiful.
Don't think most people noticed it going by, but I love it. It's yeah. a really good, one of those fragments, you know, it's like a little vignette.
Yeah.
You notice this waitress and she's kind. And she's yeah. like being nice to human beings. And she leaves a wake of
she's leaving beast. Crumbs, as Jan says.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah. I really liked that song. I yeah. liked that set of words. I thought it was really good. And that's
yeah,
me
great.
And Dean Parks. He did a
oh,
good
wow.
job.
It's beautiful. And it's also really your life, like just being here for the last couple of days, like that's who you're seeing in the course of your day.
if I can, yeah.
Yeah.
If I see one, I always go back to that place.
Yeah.
You know, because I collect decent human beings. Mm-hmm. I collect human beings that are being nice to other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
They lift my spirits. They make me feel not so lonely. And that's good.
We were talking about that last night, about feeling lonely as one gets older. And it's something I struggle with, too. Because, well, for one thing, you don't have, you know, college friends hanging out with you and all that. We went out to dinner last night and, like, you know, five people came up to the table and said hi. And, you know, I mean, I get recognized sometimes for being a writer. It's hard to keep track of everybody's face. You can't remember everybody's name. Has some level of fame contributed to your isolation and loneliness over the years?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lot of it has to do with how, you know, it, as usual, it has to do with where your focus is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't accept it very, very much at all. Remember me telling you that my dad used his Oscar for a doorstop?
Wow. I don't remember, but yeah, I believe
okay,
it.
Okay, well,
yeah,
it's that kind of thing. I don't want to get too, I saw so many people start to buy into their own fame.
Right.
And I saw it destroy them as human beings.
Right.
That I've like been repelled by it and been from the get-go. I reject fame.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I don't think celebrity is a real thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think fame is a real thing at all. I think it's usually a straw man trick where life tries to set you up bigger than life and then it can knock you down.
Right.
I think it's bullshit. I don't think I'm any different than anybody else. I think I put my pants on one leg at a time, same as everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've got gifted some talent. Mm-hmm. I don't think that makes me smarter or better, either one.
Mm-hmm.
I think I can get better by behaving better, by looking for the significant value in things and trying to follow that and behave better.
Mm-hmm.
I can get better. I don't think you come here better. I don't think I got any reason to believe in fame or celebrity at all.
Mm-hmm.
The respect of my peers. Fuck yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Love it.
Mm-hmm.
The honest admiration in somebody's eyes when they say, you know, I got married to your song laughing.
Right.
Because it moves me.
Yeah.
Well, I love that, man.
Yeah.
That matters to me.
Yeah.
Being on the cover of Rolling Stone doesn't fucking matter to me.
Yeah.
Being a star, I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
It doesn't help. And look, somebody asked me, what do I judge people by?
Mm-hmm.
Who have you helped?
Mm-hmm.
What have you created?
Mm-hmm.
What did you make better?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I judge myself by.
Right.
That's what I judge you by.
Yeah.
And everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has nothing to do with whether you've been on the cover.
Right.
I've been on there four times, five times. I don't know. I don't give a shit.
Right.
It's not what counts.
Right.
It counts what effect you have, what you've brought to the party, what you've created, what you made better. That counts.
Right.
In my scale.
Yeah.
That counts deeply and will count forever.
Please join me and Osiris next week as we conclude my in-depth exploration of the soul and art of David Crosby. We'll talk about the forces that finally tore apart one of the first supergroups, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, with whom David did some of his best work, but eventually felt confined as a member of a hugely popular band that got locked into playing its hits. We'll also talk about David's relationship with the members of the Grateful Dead and play a rare track of David and Graham Nash jamming with the Dead at their peak. Freak Flag Flying is executive produced by Adam Kaplan and Tom Marshall. Interview, narration, and editing by me, Steve Silberman. Mixed and mastered at Telescope Audio. Promotions by Christina Collins and RJB. And thank you all for listening.
Dancing out their heart into the sky.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with.
The way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.